A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. Male mental health for new fathers. He says it's hugely under-discussed, that a lot of men feel their role shrinks to some peripheral support figure whose own needs get forgotten, and he's asking how dads and families can avoid that or figure a way out. And honestly, the timing on this is right, because there's new data that's actually quantifying what's been anecdotal for years.
There really is. The American Psychological Association put out a major piece on this. They found that about 10% of new fathers experience paternal depression, and that number jumps to closer to 25% when the mother is also depressed. And here's what gets me. The peak onset isn't in those first sleepless weeks. It's at the 3 to 6 month mark.
Which is exactly when everyone stops asking how you're doing.
The casseroles stop coming, the texts dry up, and suddenly the father is supposed to have figured out his new identity. But the research shows that's precisely when the psychological floor falls out for a lot of men. The CDC has been tracking this. Their data on paternal depression shows it's most common between 3 and 6 months postpartum. Not the crisis of birth, not the first chaotic week, the quiet part.
It's the emotional equivalent of everyone leaving the party, and you're stuck with the cleanup and nobody's even acknowledged you hosted.
That's the image. And what makes this distinct from maternal postpartum depression, which gets far more attention, and rightly so, is how it presents. Men don't typically report sadness. They report irritability, emotional detachment, increased substance use, working longer hours. The NHS guidance on this is actually quite good. They note that men are more likely to present with anger and escapism than with crying spells.
The diagnostic framework itself is skewed toward a presentation that's more common in mothers, and dads walk around undiagnosed because their symptoms read as being a jerk, rather than being depressed.
And that's the first layer of the problem. The second layer is that men are less likely to seek help even when they recognize something's wrong. The APA piece cites numbers showing that only about 25% of fathers experiencing depressive symptoms actually reach out to a professional.
That's staggeringly low. Though I suppose the question is, reach out to whom? If you're a new father and you go to your GP and say you're exhausted and irritable, the response is often, congratulations, you have a newborn, this is normal. Which it might be, but it might not be.
That's the diagnostic challenge. Sleep deprivation alone produces symptoms that mimic depression, cognitive fog, emotional volatility, reduced patience. So the clinician has to distinguish between this person needs sleep and this person needs intervention. The NHS guidelines emphasize screening fathers when the mother presents with postpartum depression because the correlation is so strong. But how many pediatrician visits include a how's dad doing screen?
I'd wager approximately zero. And that's not even a criticism of pediatricians. It's just not built into the workflow. The baby gets weighed, the mother gets a postpartum depression screener, and the father is the person in the corner holding the diaper bag.
There was a study out of Sweden, and this is important because Sweden has one of the most generous paternity leave policies in the world, that found even there fathers reported feeling invisible in healthcare settings. They described themselves as the invisible passenger in their own family's medical journey. If you're getting that in Sweden, imagine what it looks like in places with no paternity leave at all.
The invisible passenger. That's the phrase that should be on the poster for this whole conversation. And it connects to what I think is the deeper psychological mechanism here. It's not just about being overlooked. It's about identity collapse. A man who defined himself by his competence, his ability to fix things, his role as a provider, suddenly enters a domain where his competence is irrelevant. He cannot lactate. He cannot soothe the baby the way the mother often can in those early months. His utility has been outsourced to biology.
The cultural scripts don't help. The dominant narrative around new fatherhood is either comic relief, bumbling dad who can't figure out the stroller, or financial provider whose emotional presence is secondary. neither script gives a man permission to say, I am profoundly destabilized by this transition, and I need help.
The bumbling dad trope has done real damage. It's been a sitcom staple for decades, and it frames male incompetence in the domestic sphere as charming and inevitable. The subtext is, don't expect much from him. And men internalize that.
Which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the baseline expectation is that you're going to be peripheral and inept, why would you fight to be central? Why would you insist on being part of the nighttime routine if everyone acts like you're doing your wife a favor by simply being present?
Let's get practical. The prompt asks how dads and families can avoid this or find a way out. And I think we need to separate this into two tracks, what the father can do himself and what the family system can do around him, because they're different interventions.
Let's start with the father. The research points to a few things that actually move the needle. First, peer connection with other fathers. Not just hanging out with your old friends who don't have kids, but finding men who are in the same trench. The APA piece describes this as one of the strongest protective factors. Men who have a space to talk about fatherhood with other fathers show significantly lower rates of depressive symptoms.
Which is counterintuitive for a lot of men because the male friendship model is often built around shared activity, not shared vulnerability. You play basketball, you watch the game, you don't sit around discussing your feelings of inadequacy as a parent.
And what's interesting is that the format matters. The successful interventions aren't dad support groups in the therapy circle model. They're structured around an activity, a walk, a project, something with a task, where conversation happens alongside. The Australian Dads in the Park program is a good example. Fathers meet outdoors with their kids, there's a facilitator, but it doesn't feel clinical. It feels like a play date where adults also talk.
The design principle is give men a reason to be in the same place, and the connection follows as a byproduct, not the stated goal. That's psychologically astute. Because the stated goal version, come to our dad's support circle, triggers every masculine aversion to vulnerability in one sentence.
It's not just about emotional support. These groups become practical knowledge exchanges. How do you handle sleep regression? What do you do when the baby only wants mom? Is it normal to feel resentment toward your own child? Those questions feel too shameful to bring up with your partner or your doctor, but in a group of dads, someone's already been through it.
The resentment question is the one that never gets asked out loud, and it's incredibly common. You love this child, you wanted this child, and you also feel displaced and sometimes angry about being displaced. Holding both those truths at once is psychologically complex, and most men have no framework for it.
There's a researcher at the University of Michigan. His name is Dr. Shauna Lee, she directs the Fatherhood and Family Lab there, who's done work on what she calls paternal gatekeeping. It's the subtle ways fathers can be pushed to the periphery, sometimes by their own partners. But a mother who says, no, let me do it, you're not doing it right, enough times is training the father to disengage.
The father who accepts that training is complicit in his own marginalization. So you get this dance where both parties reinforce each other's roles. She becomes the expert, he becomes the assistant, and then they both resent the dynamic they've co-created.
The fix for that, according to the research, is early involvement. Fathers who are hands-on in the first weeks, diaper changes, bathing, soothing, establish a pattern that persists. The problem is that in many cases, the father returns to work after a week or two while the mother remains on leave, and that asymmetry hardens into a permanent division of labor.
The structural answer is paternity leave, but that's a policy lever, not something an individual family can control. What do you do if you're a father with 2 weeks of leave and a job that expects you back at full capacity?
You negotiate the non-work hours differently, and this is where the conversation with the partner becomes critical. The research suggests that the key variable isn't the total number of hours the father spends on childcare. It's whether he has a domain of genuine competence and responsibility. Not helping out. The bath routine. The bedtime story. The Sunday morning shift where mom sleeps in. Something that is his, where he develops actual expertise, and where his absence would create a gap, not an inconvenience.
That's a profound reframe. The difference between I help with the baby, and I am the person who does this thing for this child, is the difference between being a supporting character and being a co-lead.
It matters for the child, too. There's good longitudinal data, And I'm thinking of work out of the University of Oxford's Department of Social Policy and Intervention, showing that children whose fathers were actively involved in direct caregiving in the first year show better cognitive outcomes at age 3. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but the correlation is robust.
The father's mental health isn't just about the father. It's a whole family variable. A depressed, disengaged father affects the child's development and the mother's well-being. Treating paternal mental health as some niche concern or luxury is missing the systemic impact.
Yet funding for paternal mental health research is a fraction of what goes to maternal mental health. I'm not saying the maternal side is overfunded, it's not, but fathers are barely in the research agenda. The NIH has only in the last few years started including fathers systematically in perinatal mental health studies.
Let's talk about the mother's role in this, because I think there's a dynamic that's uncomfortable to name. A new mother is going through her own identity earthquake, her own hormonal cascade, her own recovery. She may not have the bandwidth to manage her partner's emotional state too, and yet the father's well-being directly affects her. So what's the right balance between she's not responsible for his feelings and they're in this together?
That's the tension. The clinical guidance tends to emphasize that partners should be alert to signs of paternal depression, but not feel responsible for fixing it. The NHS recommends that if a partner notices persistent irritability, withdrawal, or what they call escapist behavior, gaming, drinking, working late, they should encourage professional help, not try to become the therapist.
Which is sensible advice that's incredibly hard to execute at 3 a.m. when you're both exhausted and someone's just said something they can't take back.
Sleep deprivation is the accelerant for every relational fire, and this is where practical interventions matter more than emotional insight. The research on sleep and paternal mental health is unambiguous. Fathers who get less than 6 hours of broken sleep per night for sustained periods show a marked increase in depressive symptoms. The single most effective thing many couples can do is implement a shift system that guarantees each parent at least one block of uninterrupted sleep.
The shift system saved my sanity. I'll say that without qualification.
It's the difference between we're both awake every time the baby cries, and I know I'm off duty from 2 to 6 and I can actually sleep. The psychological effect of knowing you have protected rest is almost as important as the rest itself.
That requires a level of explicit negotiation that many couples are not good at. You have to say out loud, here is when I will not be available. Here is when you will not be available. Here is the handoff protocol. It feels absurdly corporate to structure your home life like a shift schedule, but the alternative is two people drowning simultaneously.
The corporate analogy is actually useful. Families are organizations. They have logistics, resource allocation, role definitions. Treating them as purely emotional units where everything should flow naturally from love is a recipe for chaos. The families that thrive are often the ones that are willing to be a little bit bureaucratic about it.
The spreadsheet families, I've met them. They're annoyingly functional.
And part of that functionality is that they make the invisible labor visible. One of the drivers of paternal disengagement is that fathers often don't see how much work is being done because it's being done while they're not present. The mother who tracks the pediatrician appointments, the clothing sizes, the feeding schedule. That cognitive load is invisible to a father who's at work all day. Making it explicit in a shared system, whether it's a whiteboard or an app, reduces the asymmetry.
It also reduces the resentment on the mother's side, because she's not constantly thinking, he doesn't even know what size diaper we're on. If it's on the board, he knows, or he should know. And if he doesn't check the board, that's a different conversation.
The board becomes the accountability mechanism, not her nagging. And that's healthier for everyone.
We've covered peer connection, domain ownership, sleep shifts, and making invisible labor visible. What about the professional help side? When does a father need to go beyond lifestyle adjustments and actually talk to someone?
The clinical threshold is basically, if symptoms persist for more than 2 weeks and interfere with functioning, it's time to seek help. But I think the more useful framing is, if you find yourself consistently not wanting to be around your child or feeling nothing when you are, that's a signal, not a moral failing. The NHS uses a screening tool called the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, which was originally designed for mothers, but there's a growing consensus that a modified version worked for fathers too.
If a father doesn't have access to therapy, or can't afford it, or lives somewhere without those resources,
the lowest barrier intervention that has evidence behind it is structured physical activity. Not hit the gym in a dismissive sense, but regular moderate exercise, ideally outdoors, has a measurable effect on depressive symptoms. The Australian Movember Foundation has funded several studies on this specifically for new fathers, and the results are encouraging. A 30-minute walk 3 times a week, consistently, shows effects comparable to some low-dose interventions.
There's something about walking that's psychologically distinct from other forms of exercise. It's bilateral stimulation. Left, right, which seems to have a processing effect on the brain. EMDR therapy uses something similar. I'm not saying a walk is therapy, but it's not nothing.
It's not nothing. And combining the walk with the peer connection piece, a regular walking group of fathers, that's a 2-for-1 intervention.
Let's get into the harder territory. Because I think part of what makes this conversation difficult is that the cultural conversation around parenting has become weirdly zero-sum. Acknowledging that fathers' struggle can feel, to some people, like it diminishes the struggles of mothers, as if empathy is a finite resource.
That's a real phenomenon, and it shows up in the research literature too. There's a term, maternal gatekeeping, we mentioned earlier, but there's also a broader cultural resistance to centering fathers in parenting narratives. Part of it is historical. The parenting advice industry was built for mothers, by mothers, and fathers were an afterthought. Part of it is political. Conversations about fatherhood can get tangled up in conversations about family structure and gender roles in ways that make people defensive.
The result is that a father who says, "This is hard for me too," gets met with, "Try giving birth," which is not a conversation. That's a shutdown.
The suffering Olympics. The fact that childbirth is a profound physical and psychological event doesn't mean that the father's experience is trivial. Both things can be true. The father didn't go through labor, but he went through a life transition that, for many men, triggers an identity crisis. That's real, even if it's not physiological.
I push back on the not physiological part. The research on hormonal changes in new fathers is actually fascinating. Men's testosterone levels drop after the birth of a child. Cortisol patterns shift. There's even some evidence of changes in oxytocin levels in fathers who are actively involved in caregiving. The idea that fathers undergo no biological change is outdated.
There was a study out of Northwestern University that tracked hormonal changes in expectant and new fathers and found significant shifts in testosterone, cortisol, and prolactin. The male body is responding to fatherhood. It's just not as visible as pregnancy, so we pretend it doesn't happen.
The male body is responding in ways we barely understand. And yet the cultural script is still, "Suck it up, you didn't push a human out of your body."
Which brings us to the intergenerational piece. A lot of new fathers are trying to be the father they didn't have. They're operating without a model. Their own fathers may have been distant, or absent, or present, but emotionally unavailable. So they're improvising, and they're doing it while exhausted, and they have no reference point for what good enough looks like.
That's a recipe for anxiety. If your only model is what you don't want to be, you're navigating by negative space. You know what you're avoiding. You don't know what you're aiming for.
That's where the peer groups become valuable in a different way, not just for emotional support, but for modeling. Seeing another father interact with his child gives you a template. You might not copy it exactly, but it shows you what's possible.
I think that's the most underrated function of community. It's not just emotional scaffolding. It's a library of behaviors you can borrow. You see someone handle a tantrum calmly and you think, "Okay, that's an option. I can try that."
The research on social learning and parenting is strong. Fathers who spend time around other fathers develop a broader repertoire of parenting behaviors. It's observational learning. You absorb techniques without even realizing you're learning.
The practical advice to a new father who's feeling peripheral and lost: find your domain, protect your sleep, find other dads, ideally through an activity, and don't wait until you're in crisis to admit this is hard. Does that cover it?
I'd add one more. Talk to your partner before the resentment calcifies. Not in a "let's process our feelings" way, if that's not your style, but in a "here's what I want my role to be, what do you need from me, how do we make this work" way. The families I've seen navigate this well treat the transition like a project they're co-managing, not a mystery they're supposed to solve through intuition.
The co-managing frame is powerful because it gives men permission to engage in a way that feels natural. planning, problem solving, logistics, while also creating space for the emotional content to emerge. You start by talking about the sleep schedule, and you end up talking about how you feel invisible. The practical becomes the doorway to the emotional.
That's a pattern that shows up in male psychology research more broadly. Men often process emotions through activity or problem solving. It's not that they don't have feelings, it's that the access point is different. The therapeutic model that works for many women, sit in a room, make eye contact, talk about your feelings, can feel alien and threatening to men. But put them in a car, or on a walk, or working on something side by side, and the same emotional material emerges naturally.
Side by side versus face to face. It's a well-documented distinction in male communication. And it means that the interventions that work for fathers might look different from the interventions that work for mothers. And that's fine. Different isn't inferior.
This is where I think the conversation about paternal mental health gets unnecessarily polarized. Some people hear men process emotions differently and hear a justification for emotional avoidance. That's not what the research says. The research says the pathway to emotional engagement might look different, but the engagement itself is the goal.
The goal is the same. The route is different. And the route is only a problem if it's a detour that never arrives.
And the detour that never arrives, that's the father who works 80-hour weeks and calls it providing, but is really escaping. Or the father who's physically present but emotionally checked out, scrolling his phone while the child plays alone. Those are the failure modes we're trying to prevent.
The phone thing is epidemic. And I don't want to sound like a technology is destroying families crank, but the smartphone is the perfect escape hatch for a father who feels inadequate. It's a portal to a world where you're competent, where you understand the rules, where nobody needs a diaper change. The pull of that versus the messy, confusing reality of caring for an infant. It's not a fair fight.
Screen time and paternal disengagement is an emerging research area, and the preliminary findings are not great. Fathers who report high smartphone use also report lower quality interactions with their children. The mechanism seems to be attentional. You can't be present with your child if part of your brain is still in your email inbox, and children notice. Even infants notice when their caregiver's attention is divided.
The still face experiment, but the still face is staring at an iPhone.
That's exactly the modern version. And the tragedy is that the father might be on his phone reading an article about how to be a better father. The intention isn't malicious, but the effect is the same.
Okay, let's talk about the systems level stuff. Because individual advice is useful, but a lot of this is structural. What should healthcare systems be doing differently?
The number one thing is screening. Include fathers in perinatal mental health screens. The pediatrician's office is the obvious touch point. It's one of the few places where both parents are present with the child in the first year. A 2-minute questionnaire for fathers, same as mothers get. It's not complicated, it just hasn't been prioritized.
If a father screens positive, what then? Because the mental health system is already strained. You can't just identify a problem and then have nowhere to send people.
That's the implementation challenge. Some health systems are experimenting with integrated behavioral health in pediatric settings. A social worker or psychologist is embedded in the practice and can do a warm handoff. The father screens positive, and instead of, here's a list of therapists, good luck, he gets a brief intervention right there, same visit. It reduces the friction dramatically.
That's the term of art.
And it matters because the drop-off between you should talk to someone and actually talking to someone is enormous. Every step of friction loses people. If you can eliminate the friction, no separate appointment, no separate location, no insurance pre-authorization, the uptake increases substantially.
What about workplace policy? Paternity leave seems like the obvious lever.
It is, and the evidence is overwhelming. Fathers who take at least 2 weeks of paternity leave report higher relationship satisfaction, higher engagement with their children, and lower depressive symptoms. The effects persist for years. Countries with paid paternity leave, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, see measurable improvements in paternal mental health outcomes. And interestingly, maternal outcomes improve too. When fathers are home, mothers recover faster.
Paternity leave is a maternal health intervention as well. That's a framing I haven't seen used much.
It should be. The data from the Nordic countries shows that paternity leave is associated with reduced maternal postpartum complications, reduced marital stress, and better child outcomes across the board. It's one of those rare policies where everybody wins.
Except the employer who loses the worker for a few weeks. And that's the objection, right?
The cost objection is short-term thinking. The long-term productivity loss from a depressed, disengaged employee is far greater than a few weeks of leave. But that's a hard case to make to a small business owner who's just trying to keep the lights on, which is why these policies need to be societal, not left to individual employers.
In the absence of policy, the burden falls on families to improvise solutions that the government could provide, but won't. That's the frustrating part of this conversation. So much of the suffering is preventable with structural changes that we know work.
It is frustrating. But I think there's value in naming what individuals can do even in a suboptimal system. Because waiting for policy to change while your mental health deteriorates isn't a strategy.
So, to the father who's listening to this and recognizing himself, the irritability, the withdrawal, the feeling of being a supporting character in his own family, what's the one thing he should do tomorrow?
1. Tell someone. Your partner, a friend, a sibling. Just say, I'm not doing great. You don't need a diagnosis or a treatment plan. You need to break the isolation. 2. Pick one domain of caregiving and own it completely. Not helping more. The morning feed. The park outing. Something where you're not the assistant. Those two things, connection and competence, are the foundation everything else builds on.
Connection and competence. That's a better framework than self-care or make time for yourself. Which is the standard advice, and which, frankly, is useless when you have a 3-month-old.
Make time for yourself is advice for people who have time. New fathers don't have time. They have scraps. The question is what they do with the scraps. And the answer isn't, take a bubble bath. It's, do something that reminds you that you're competent at something.
Or do something with another adult who sees you as a person, not a diaper-changing appliance.
The identity piece is central. Fatherhood can swallow your identity if you let it. The goal isn't to resist that. Becoming a father should change you, but it shouldn't erase you. And the difference between transformation and erasure is whether there's still a self left that you recognize.
That's the line. Becoming a father changes you. It shouldn't delete you.
The families that navigate this well are the ones where both parents are allowed to change, both are allowed to struggle, and neither is expected to be the supporting actor in the other's story.
The answer to the prompt, how do dads and families avoid this or figure a way out, is partly practical and partly philosophical. The practical, sleep shifts, domain ownership, peer connection, screening, paternity leave where possible. The philosophical, reject the bumbling dad script, reject the idea that fathers are peripheral, reject the zero-sum framing that pits maternal needs against paternal needs. Build a family culture where competence is expected from both parents and struggle is acknowledged in both parents.
If you're already in the hole, if you're 6 months in and you feel nothing, or you feel angry all the time, or you're drinking more than you used to, treat it like you'd treat a physical injury. You wouldn't walk on a broken leg for 6 months and hope it heals itself. Don't do that with your brain either.
The broken leg analogy is good. Men will ignore a broken leg for about 20 minutes before seeking help. They'll ignore depression for years.
Because depression tells you it's not real. It tells you you're just weak or lazy or not trying hard enough. That's the nature of the condition. It lies to you about its own existence.
The lie is easier to believe when everyone around you is also pretending everything's fine. Which is why the first step is always breaking the silence, even if it's awkward, even if you don't have the right words.
Especially if you don't have the right words. The right words come later. The first words just have to be true. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, the last known speaker of the Lenca language in Honduras, a tongue once used across vast stretches of Mesoamerica, died without passing it on, marking the disappearance of an entire linguistic tradition that had encoded centuries of Polynesian wayfinding knowledge transmitted through ancient Pacific crossings.
A lot of geography in one sentence.
I'm gonna need a map and a timeline and possibly a nap.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.